Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jim Bettinger, director of the John S. Knight Fellowships for Professional Journalists at Stanford. Find the club on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure tonight to introduce our distinguished speakers, Lance Williams and Mark Fanaru-Wada, San Francisco Chronicle reporters and authors of Game of Shadows, Barry Bonds, Balco, and the steroid scandal that rocked professional sports. You could argue that our speakers tonight are the most influential individuals in baseball today, because their reporting and writing has forced the game's ruling officials to confront the prevalence of steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs in professional sports. Not only did they report closely on the investigation for the San Francisco Chronicle and then for their book, they also disclosed that a number of prominent baseball players, including Jason Giambi and Barry Bonds, had testified before a federal grand jury about steroid use, although Bonds testified that if he did use steroids, it was unwitting. Those and other stories have exposed Williams and Fanaru-Wada to legal challenge, as federal prosecutors now want the two to disclose their sources or be held in contempt of court. And just to show you that the Commonwealth Club hews closely to the news, just yesterday a judge ordered Greg Anderson, Barry Bonds' personal trainer, to federal prison for refusing to testify. So you can tell that this isn't an idle threat. Please welcome Lance Williams and Mark Fanaru-Wada, who will enlighten us more about steroids and baseball.
Well, thank you. We both want to thank the Commonwealth Club so much for having us. It's really an honor for us to be here, and we're really flattered to be able to talk to you about our book and the work we've done at the Chronicle. What we like to do is prattle on for a little bit amongst ourselves, try and enlighten you a little bit about what's in the book and came out of the reporting for maybe 20 minutes or so, and then do what we prefer to do, which is answer questions and let you find out really what you want to know. But I figured I would start first by just telling you a little bit about the book that is really a byproduct of about 2 years of reporting that we did for the Chronicle after we were assigned to cover the Balco, what's now known as the Balco investigation. The book, as Lance likes to say, if you're just interested in finding out why we say that Barry Bonds used steroids, you don't need to read the book. You can just, we don't like to say this, but he says it's anyway. You can just skip to the very end. There's an appendix at the back. And one of the appendices has a litany of items that sort of provide the quote-unquote mountain of evidence that exists that Bonds used performance-enhancing drugs. But we like to think that there's actually a pretty good story to be told in there and that there's some really fascinating characters. And I thought I'd tell you a little bit about a few of those folks before Lance chats for a bit. Of course there's Barry Bonds, who is this clearly larger-than-life figure, who presents himself as remarkably self-absorbed, to the point of, he's absolutely cynical about the business of baseball, to the point of pragmatism. I mean, he clearly perhaps knows the game better than anybody. He makes a conscious decision, seeing the way the game is evolving, to use these performance-enhancing drugs after the 1998 season. And it's a decision that clearly transforms him into a better ball player than he's ever been in his life. But Bonds is, as fascinating a character as Bonds is, I always think, for me personally, Victor Conti is the most fascinating character that we've written about. He's the guy who is at the center of this story. He's a self-made scientist, if you will. He's a junior college dropout who studied accounting for a little bit, then decided he wanted to get into the nutrition business, which is, of course, natural progression from accounting. And then he decides he's going to spend a lot of time in the Stanford Medical Library, where he learns a lot about steroids. And ultimately, this most unlikely of figures turns himself into perhaps the most influential figure in baseball and in sports, certainly in some time. He insinuates himself into the highest levels of sport. And really, he is a testament to, the book in many ways is titled because of what Conti has done. Game of Shadows, the games are being played out in the shadows, and Conti is a dramatic sort of illustration of that. Beyond Conti, there's a number of other fascinating folks, and some are fairly tragic figures in the book. There's a woman named Kelly White, who's a track star from around these parts, from Union City. She grows up she's got a family whose background is in sports and very successful at the Olympic level. And she, from an early age, is seen as somebody who's got the talent to succeed at the highest levels. She gets caught up with a coach named Remy Korchemny from the age of 10. And Korchemny is a guy who is intimately involved, it turns out, in the Balka scandal. And Kelly White ultimately makes the decision, based on pressure from Korchemny and Victor Conti, that if she's going to be able to reach the heights of her sport, then she's going to need to use these drugs. One of the underlying messages of the book is that you need to cheat or lose. That's the Victor Conti sort of message. It's either use these drugs or move on to another profession. Kelly White ultimately makes that choice, and I think we would argue that though she's tragic in some ways, she's one of the few heroic figures in the book because she ultimately comes clean about what she's done and admits her use of the drugs and tries to talk about the problems of that. Another figure, even more tragic than Kelly, is a kid named Rob Garibaldi, who's also from the Bay Area. Rob is from up in Petaluma, and he's a kid who was a high school baseball star and then ultimately a college baseball star at USC, one of the preeminent college baseball programs in the country. And Rob's only real problem is that he's just too small. From early on, at the age of 15, he's told that he needs to start using supplements. He's got to get bigger. He's just not quite big enough. And so he happens to have a coach who's a supplement dealer, and that supplement dealer starts providing him with stuff like Andro and creatine. These are things you've heard about, perhaps. And ultimately, Rob decides that he's not quite getting big enough, and he makes the decision to start using steroids. And tragically, that leads Rob, at the age of 24, his parents will tell you, into a depression that results in him killing himself. And one of the things that we think is, a lot of people ask, why are steroids in sports important? And I think one of the things we have talked about is that, we'd like to think, immodestly, our work, but all of the sort of stories that have come out of the steroids case have created a national dialogue about steroid use, not just at the professional level, but certainly at the high school level. At this point, I'll be nice. Lance can tell you a little bit about maybe how we got into working on this story.
Sure. Occasionally people will ask, wow, how'd you decide to target Barry Bonds? How did the Chronicle decide to go after the home run king? I've got to tell you, just didn't unfold that way at all. In the beginning, Mark was a new reporter on the investigative team at the Chronicle. It was the fall of 2003. He'd come over from sports. I was working on the recall campaign, if you recall Governor Schwarzenegger's ascension. And in the middle of that, the feds kicked in the door at what I thought was a vitamin company down by the airport. And our Metro staff had trouble kind of getting a handle on it. And our editor had an extra reporter suddenly, and he asked Mark just to go down there and try to find out what was going on. So there's no decision to target anybody or anything. And really the reporting from that day to yesterday afternoon when we were in federal court on this Anderson matter has just been trying to establish what's going on despite various levels of government secrecy and reluctance on the part of the people we're trying to write about to tell us what's happening. In the early days, Mark was on the story by himself. I did get to watch him work because we were sharing a little office space. And, he threw himself into this story and in short order called just about everybody I could think of that you'd want to talk to about this raid on this place called Balco, which turned out to be a nutritional supplement lab in which he quickly established had some of the greatest athletes in the world as clients, dealing with reluctant sources often. In the early going, Mark nevertheless made contact with people who talked to him in part because they had clients or people they cared about who were caught up in this thing, and everybody was trying to find out what the government was doing. The government had a grand jury going, but hadn't issued any indictments. No one knew where it was headed. And in the early going, Mark did manage to establish facts that we now all take for granted, but at the time were big scoops that this was a federal investigation into steroid dealing, that these elite athletes were suspected of using banned drugs. Those were big stories for the Chronicle in the fall of 2003. I came on as a second reporter about a month in and to help Mark. And I remember when I first got in on the story, I wasn't sure how much help I was going to be. He had done such a good job of scoping out the universe of prospective sources and was already really more wired than any reporter in the country on the story. And I told my boss I didn't know what I could actually do. And he said, well, you know, you can pull some documents with him and I'll get you out of there if we don't need two people on it. Then it really in the course of just getting started on it, I ran into a person I had known for more than 20 years and had used as a news source occasionally over the years. And golly, he brought up Balco. He said, do you know this Balco case? Well, I know some guys. They know the whole story of bonds and steroids. And from that conversation, we got introduced to a second sort of constellation of sources who knew about what was going on down there and eventually pointed us towards the stories that we managed to get that, in our opinion, do prove without a doubt that Bonds was using banned drugs. Reporting was so hard because, in part, of the internal ground rules of the paper. Of course, we used unnamed sources throughout this endeavor. We every day talked to people that we just can't give up their names because that's not the arrangement we have. But for the key facts, we always had to have a document. And so that's why the work was so difficult and painstaking and sort of long-term to get the documents that we did. Mark sometimes says, well, Lance, did you ever have an aha moment, you know, one moment that stands out above all the others in the reporting? And I always say, well, it was the time I got to hear a tape of Bond's trainer, this guy Greg Anderson, who just went to jail yesterday. It was a tape made without his knowledge. I had heard about it months before I actually got to hear it. And on it, you could hear him talking. He talks for about 9 minutes. He talks about his expertise with steroids. And then he starts talking about the undetectables he gave to Barry to beat baseball's testing, how we know when they're going to test, how when we get past the test, we can just go crazy. There's even a discussion of Bond's morale, how he's hitting, how that plays off, how he his mental approach to the game. It is the most persuasive single piece of evidence in the whole stack of evidence I ever heard that Bonds was doing what we say he was doing. And I do remember coming back the first time I heard it was in an office that was closed for business on a holiday. And I remember coming back to Mark and thinking, golly, we really do have a shot at getting this story. That's a little about some of the reporting. I think, Mark, you wanted to talk a little bit about some other aspects of the book.
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes, particularly these days, there's so much focus on Barry Bonds, and so many people, whenever we get asked about the book, just want to talk to us about Bonds, and we'll welcome any and all of those questions when they come up from Jim. But I also like to point out that there's a lot more, actually, to the book than Bonds. The Balco investigation focused on a number of athletes, not just baseball players, but track and field stars and football players as well. And I just point out a couple of things that I think are sort of fairly noteworthy or interesting aspects that made us enjoy doing the book and sort of providing us a different forum than we had at the paper. You know, the book is certainly part Bonds. There's about a third of it that's Bonds, a third of it that is sort of Victor Conti and the evolution of Balco and his work with these track and field athletes primarily. And then one third, sort of as Lance likes to characterize it, true crime, where it's the unveiling of the Balco investigation. And so there's a few things in that element of the book that I think are worth noting. One is there's a guy named Jeff Nowitzki. And Jeff Nowitzki is an Internal Revenue Service special agent for their criminal investigations unit. But he's not the kind of IRS agent you or I are typically fearful of for the obvious reasons. Special Agent Nowitzki's job is to track, in many cases, drug money laundering cases. And that's what Balco really is at its core. It's a money laundering case. These guys are making money off of dealing drugs. So Nowitzki is a guy who you see in the book, one of the things he does is he's sort of a traditional gumshoe kind of private eye or investigator. One of the things he likes to do is dig through trash. So Nowitzki spent every Monday virtually for about I don't know, a year digging through Victor Conti's trash. It was a routine, and if you looked at the documents from Balko, you saw this routine where Novitzky would head out to Balko at about 10 or 11 or 12 o'clock at night sometimes, sometimes in the rain, certainly in the cold Burlingame. He'd pull the trash out of the back of Victor Conti, behind Victor Conti's lab. He'd stuff it in his trunk, and then he'd drive down the block about a mile or so, and then he'd start rifling through the trash, and he'd pull out any number of things that, as it turns out, were sort of tricks of the doping trade. He pulled out empty cartons of human growth hormone, empty syringes, boxes. He pulled out letters and documents that seemed to be implicative of the conspiracy. He pulled out at one point a document that related to Barry Bonds and how, strangely enough, the Balko guys had sent some of Bonds' blood to a lab to be tested for steroids, but then they got a little worried. And they said, wait a minute, Greg said, we don't want Barry's name on this blood sample. We better change it. So they changed the name of the sample from Barry Bonds to Greg Anderson, the trainer, just to protect Barry. And that's another thing that Novitzky found in the trash. Another thing that Novitzky did, which was even more disturbing, was that he also went through Victor's medical waste. And so I don't remember what day of the week that would be, but he would go every weekly, I think, maybe it was every other week. He would go to a medical waste disposal place in Oakland. It was just an absolutely foul-smelling place, disgusting. And he had a subpoena, and he got Victor's medical waste. And there, sure enough, more tricks of the doping trade. Disposed actual needles, syringes, human growth, remnants of human growth hormone. At one point, he picked up a bag that was sort of spoke to the mad scientist nature of Victor Conti. It was a plastic bag, and inside was a container of something. You couldn't really tell what it was, and Victor or somebody from the lab had written on the front of it, "What is this?" So these are the kinds of things that Novitzky found as he built his case. Another part of the book that I think is pretty interesting and talks about sort of the unraveling of the investigation is there's a whole series of email exchanges that go on between Victor Conti and the people who are part of the conspiracy with him, Remy Korchemny, this coach, and athletes who are admitting to using the drugs, basically. And there's one point where Conti is trying a new drug, and these emails are just fascinating because they have a new drug that they've decided they want to start using. It's a stimulant called modafinil, which is supposed to be for legitimate uses for people who have narcolepsy, but it's actually a stimulant that helps an athlete focus as they get ready for a race. And Victor calls this in his little alphabet, it's just like his hidden code, vitamin S. And so there's a point where they're deciding whether they can use vitamin S, and they have an athlete, a guy named Alvin Harrison, who's a track star. And there's these exchanges between Korchemny and Conti, where Conti says, you know, we want you to use the vitamin S on Alvin, see how it's working. And Korchemny says, well, you know, I gave the vitamin S to Alvin. We know he's supposed to wait for an hour, but he was chomping at the bit after 45 minutes, as if Alvin was a horse. He was just chomping at the bit to start running. And then he says, and you wouldn't believe it, Alvin ran like 44 seconds when they expected that he was going to run 45 or 46. And lo and behold, the drugs work. And there, you can see the time period, and the next thing you know, Victor sends out an email about vitamin S that essentially says, hey, we're ready to rock and roll, let's go. And vitamin S becomes a part of the Balko regimen of drugs. So those are, you know, the track athletes are really an integral part of the story, and I would welcome anybody to sort of look at the widespread use of the drugs in track and field as well as just in baseball. The last thing before we answer questions is, Lance and I talked about it'd be great if Lance could update you guys. A lot has certainly happened since the book came out, including obviously Mr. Anderson heading off to jail yesterday. So, and Lance is going to update you on that.
Another character in our book is a woman called Kimberly Bell, who was Bond's girlfriend for a long time, ended really badly, and we interviewed her extensively before she became a federal witness against Bonds in this perjury case. And I haven't been able to interview her since she became a federal witness, but I did get to hear from her after our book came out, and I really wanted to hear from her, hear what she thought. And she said, well, you know, I like the book pretty well, but there's something wrong with it. And I said, well, what's that, Kim? And she said, it doesn't have an ending. And I didn't like that criticism that well. I think we've got a perfectly good ending in our book, but also know what she was talking about. You know, events that are described in the book have continued to unfold since the book was published, and I just thought I'd mention a couple of them. First, of course, this perjury investigation of Bonds himself, which is referenced in the book. Miss Bell was the first witness they heard from on that. Bonds, in his testimony, said he never knowingly took steroids. Kimberly testified that way back in 2000, he confided in her that he was using steroids, that he had used them to get over some injuries and, in fact, had hurt his elbow as a result of overusing them. Since the book came out, actually this spring, all of a sudden the subpoenas have been flying around town. The Giants trainer, Bonds' personal orthopedist, other witnesses, and ultimately Greg Anderson, his weight trainer, and I would say his steroid dealer, have all been hauled down to 450 Golden Gate. Most have testified. Mr. Anderson didn't and went to prison for contempt. We think there'll be a decision on whether to indict for perjury in the coming weeks. That'll be an amazing event if the government decides to go forward. Overshadowed by all this is another investigation. That's Senator George Mitchell's baseball investigation that was launched actually in response to our book. That's a hard slog, in our opinion. Nobody seems to want to talk to the senator. The players' union have told the players, don't do it without your lawyer. The government witnesses have been told by the government, we'd prefer you save your testimony for federal court. And other interested parties just haven't really come across. And so Senator Mitchell we know he's out there, and we know he's trying to talk to people. I guess he's got an appointment with Jose Canseco coming up. But the fact-finding is going slowly there. A third event I'll just mention, there was a raid in Scottsdale, Arizona, by this same federal agent that Mark mentioned, Jeff Nowitzki, in which they wound up kicking in the door of a mop-up man for the Diamondbacks, a guy called Jason Grimsley. And in an interview with Nowitzki, Grimsley gave up quite a bit about his life as a user of performance-enhancing drugs in baseball. I guess the highlight there is when he says, you know, when they started testing us for steroids, I switched to human growth hormone because they don't test for that. Sort of opening the window on the completely rational behavior of baseball drug cheats. Why would you take something you could get caught using when they don't test for this other stuff that's just as effective? I guess the final thing I just mentioned, the final event I'd mention, is, of course, the legal proceedings involving my favorite authors, me and Mark. We were subpoenaed to testify before yet another grand jury. This one's looking at who leaked to us certain documents that we used in our stories at the Chronicle. We think there are important First Amendment issues raised by the government's subpoena. Unprecedented in this part of the world, maybe unprecedented in the history of the Justice Department to come after reporters for a source on a case like this. We have a hearing in August in federal court, and as part of what's an expensive litigation that Hearst Corporation, which owns the Chronicle, has cheerfully assumed the responsibility for, and bless their hearts. So that's just kind of an update, and we'd be pleased to take questions.
Okay. Before we do that, I want to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we're talking tonight with Lance Williams and Mark Fainaruwata, San Francisco Chronicle reporters and authors of Game of Shadows, Barry Bonds, Balco, and the steroid scandal that rocked professional sports. I have a number of questions that deal with the last issue you mentioned, which is the legal proceedings against your favorite authors.
It's our favorite topic.
Yes. And so there's. Let me sort of combine them into one question that you can with several parts. One is, isn't it true that confidential sources is dedicated to protecting whistleblowers and not necessarily people who violate judges' orders by leaking grand jury transcripts. Isn't there a question of the fact that this that you work for a for-profit venture, then sort of taking it upon yourselves to override, in essence, the judge's instructions that this be kept secret? And beyond that, what's the legal jeopardy, not only for yourself, but for the Chronicle, and what sort of discussions went into whether or not you would use this information? I think this is specifically about the grand jury transcripts.
I'll take whistleblower, and then you take the next two, something like that.
Sure. I'd really argue that the source that we are protecting in this case is a whistleblower in the truest and best sense of the word. If you look at what went on in this case, the government in the Balco raids obtained evidence that elite athletes were using illegal drugs. That's a crime. The government decided to countenance that, excuse that, not prosecute them. They brought them in as witnesses at the grand jury and gave them immunity in exchange for their testimony against the dope dealers. After the grand jury hearings ended, some of these athletes went out and made public statements that were completely in opposition to what they had told the grand jury. Two that I can think of right off the bat went out and said, I never used steroids, having gone inside and testified that they had. The government countenanced and tolerated that. At the time the indictments were handed up and the court papers were filed, all the elite athletes' names were excised from the public record. You couldn't find out the role these multimillionaire athletes played in this drug conspiracy. Some people around the Balco case thought this was not right. They thought that if you wanted to clean up sport, as the government said it wanted to do, that you had to expose the athletes. And so, to me, the sources that helped us were blowing the whistle on a series of government decisions to keep secret from the public really the only information anybody wanted to know in this darn case. And that's our rationale for calling these guys whistleblowers.
To the two other points, I'll address the legal jeopardy we or the Chronicle might face first. You know, the Chronicle's jeopardy would be presumably huge fines, I guess, for Hearst Corporation. That's something the government has Attorney General Gonzalez's office and the government have sought to do is levy fines on these big corporations as a means of trying to dissuade them from protecting sources. For Lance and myself, the ultimate, I guess, end game would be jail. You know, if you're familiar with the Judith Miller case in the New York Times, she served about 2 months before she came out. I like to joke about this. Lance hates it, but I do it anyway just because it amuses me that Lance and I have cut a deal already between ourselves that because he has older kids than I do, he's going to do the jail time. His kids are gone. He's going to take care of that and cover us on that front. So I feel a little relieved about that. You know, as to the – and he just nods. Yeah. He's not happy about it. The for-profit issue, you know – I guess I would just say, I mean, I'm trying to interpret that question, which is I'm assuming it's the reasons you wrote these stories were strictly for profit and personal motives of profit. You know, I would say this is something I do steal from Lance. You know, look, if anybody who knows anything about the journalism business knows you don't get into it to make money, nor the book business. Our book is an aberration in that it's succeeding, and perhaps we might actually see a little money from it. But the reality is that you don't get into this business to make money. We got into this story that, as Lance pointed out, we were assigned to cover because it was an ongoing story that clearly spoke to a number of important levels we believed and still believe, not just about kids but about professional sports and what they are and whether they're real or not and what you're seeing and whether it's real. As Lance also notes, that I think he did the math at one point, and I think he makes in a year what Barry Bonds makes in about four innings, is it?
No, it's six innings.
Six, I'm sorry. So,
I got a raise.
Wait, I didn't.
All right. Actually, let me follow up on one element of it. You know, a lot of journalists felt last year during the Judith Plame case that that reporters who were protecting sources were undercut when first Matt Cooper and Time Magazine and then Judith Miller went to jail, but then ultimately testified about the source. What's your feeling about the level of support you're getting from other journalists, and sort of how do you go at this? How do you think about this? This is not an easy thing to think about.
You know, the support from journalists has been heartening. We haven't had any of the. There was some naysaying and some about the Miller and Cooper case, but that's because the fact situations are so different. I mean, golly, that was a spy case involving national security. It's much harder to argue to the public that you shouldn't be required to give your evidence in something that strikes at the heart of the protection of our nation and our intelligence apparatus and so forth. Golly, this is a baseball story, you know, and there isn't even an ongoing investigation of the Balco case. Those guys have already done their time and gotten out. And I think it's for reasons like that that even some journalists who are a little skeptical about Cooper and Miller can see that you have to go down the line here. I mean, if we can't, the government seems to want to say that any time they want a reporter's source, that's just about all they have to say. And if we can't protect a source in this case, I just don't think you can protect them. And that's going to change journalism and the way it's conducted in profound ways. And it's not going to be good for the national discourse.
We'll switch away from the journalistic issues for a minute. Can you offer a compelling argument that these drugs are qualitatively different in their uses from common pharmaceuticals, or in general, what's so bad about performance enhancement?
Sure. I mean, this is not an argument based on the medical issue. This is an argument based strictly on the legal issue. I think one thing people forget is the drugs are illegal. It is a federal offense. It has been a federal offense since 1991 to use or possess these drugs, steroids, human growth hormone, and the like. So there's clearly a distinction the government and the FDA have made between these types of drugs and drugs you might be able to obtain, you know, at the GNC. But there certainly is enough anecdotal evidence from the medical profession that tells you that these drugs are not to be taken lightly, that they have serious health effects possibly, particularly for young people. There's serious health serious effects on the psyche of young people. There's also discussions about the effects of possible effects such as heart disease. You know, one of the drugs that's at the heart of the case is human growth hormone, and there's a disease attributed to human growth hormone called acromegaly. Your head gets bigger, your organs get bigger, your hands get bigger. That can't be good. I'm not a doctor, and I know that can't be good. You know, these drugs there are legitimate medical purposes for the drugs. Growth hormone, for example, is a drug used to treat AIDS wasting disease. It's a drug used to treat dwarfism, but they're not designed for the use of for use by highly highly trained healthy individuals.
This is a question that addresses something that a lot of us feel from time to time, which is Marion Jones clean now? I'd like to root for her. And it really addresses the notion of suspension of disbelief or something about our people who we admire as athletes.
Sure. We don't, you know, the book ends at the end of 2003. We don't speculate on drug use by people subsequent to that. There's significant evidence that Marion Jones used banned drugs right along up through the Olympics. Certainly, her ex gave a statement to the federal agents that stated flat out she was injecting herself with growth hormone and using other drugs at the Sydney Games in 2000 when she won all those medals. Perhaps she's cleaned up since we stopped reporting on it.
But the further issue of sort of like how we want to admire and root for people.
Well, I understand that. You know, I'm a sports fan, and I But it's really difficult with some of these characters for me, just as a fan, to buy back in. Drug cheating just changes the performance standards. It changes so many of the basic things you want to believe about when you follow a sport. It's difficult. It's one of the sort of collateral reasons why sport needs to clean up, because they offer us, this vision of sport as pure and real, and when you get the idea that it's not, that it's phony, then you're on the track to being a pro wrestling fan, you know?
I mean, and yet I think that is one of the interesting elements of the story, is that I always think from the very beginning there's been sort of a massive disconnect for fans, that on the one hand, if you walked up to somebody taking their kid to a Giants game and said, would you want your son or daughter to be using any of these substances? They would, I mean, hopefully all of them would say, no, of course not. And yet those same people, when Bonds is at the plate and hitting a ball 500 feet and into the water, are out of their seats with their kids screaming like crazy. So I think for the public, there's a difficulty to digest the story in some ways that makes it, I don't know, perhaps difficult to get your arms around.
I want to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, talking tonight with Lance Williams and Mark Fanaru-Wada. I want to expand this a little bit beyond baseball and track and field, which is what you had written so effectively about. There's a current scandal going on in France with the Tour de France. Is this not just a U.S. issue, but an international issue, and how, if you can sort of speculate, what other areas will we see it? I haven't heard anything about this in the World Cup, for instance, but I'm just wondering what other sports we might find this in.
Well, I mean, you know, for years the Americans, interestingly enough, were viewed sort of as the ultimate doping hypocrites. This is one of the things we talk about in the book. The Americans were very quick to sort of point at the Chinese or to point at the East Germans and any number of other countries as you know, doping as a means of success. And they were right in many cases, but of course they weren't really turning a lens. The Americans were not turning a lens on themselves. I think there's no question the story is international. Even in the Balko, the athletes are international. There's some international athletes. This is not, one of the things that we always say is, I knew virtually nothing about steroids or performance-enhancing drugs before this story started, and we've both gone to school considerably, and one of the things I feel I can say comfortably is that I could find you, or we could certainly find you somebody who could find you a drug that would be highly effective for virtually any sport that you would want to compete in. And also that the lesson of Balko is that the athletes were using an array of performance-enhancing drugs that were designed either specifically or known to be able to avoid detection. That was the whole purpose of using the drugs. It was A, to enhance performance, but B, to be able to avoid detection. And that's going to be true in virtually all sports. Cycling, when soccer and the World Cup celebrates the fact that they have no positive tests, this is now the language of doping. There are no positive tests. Somebody didn't test positive. And I've come to look at that with disdain, because I don't think it means anything. I mean, that's the whole point of Balko. You weren't going to test positive if you were using this array of substances. So I think virtually every sport needs to be looked at with some sort of skepticism.
Do you believe that any professional sports organization has the ability to police steroid abuse, or should this be done by the government?
Well, that's a good question. There is the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, which runs the doping control for our Olympic athletes. I think the pro sports would not want to have them in charge of that, simply because some of the testing procedures are so intrusive. There's the practically 24/7 in competition and out competition demands for urine samples and so forth, and yet those guys are a lot more serious about it than, say, baseball, which doesn't even try to test for growth hormone and so forth. Mark says cheaters are always going to be ahead of the testers, and that's true until there's a technological leap for it on the part of drug testers. But still, the sports have to stay after it. You will catch a certain number of cheaters, and you will raise the awareness about health issues on these young athletes. These are young people in competitive situations where if they win, they're going to be famous and rich, and if they don't get the job, don't make the team, don't win the race, they're going back to drive a recycling truck back home. You know, the stakes are hugely high, and we do them a disservice by forcing them to choose banned drugs or else give up on their dreams of being elite athletes.
I think that speaks to the cheat or lose thing that you both had mentioned, which I found a very compelling quandary for a highly competitive athlete.
No, it's true, and it's funny. Victor Conti steals that line, I think, from, of all people, Charlie Francis. And for those of you who maybe remember the 1988 Olympics, Charlie Francis is the coach of a Canadian sprinter named Ben Johnson. And he's really sort of the seminal moment for many people in the doping story. The East Germans are sort of viewed as changing the nature of doping by turning it into sort of a state-sponsored event. But I think for the general public, Ben Johnson being exposed after he breaks the world record and wins the 100 meters in 88 is really the seminal moment in doping. And his coach is Charlie Francis, who espouses this sort of theory of cheat or lose.
Back to the legal case for a minute. Victor Conti only served a few months. Greg Anderson only a few months. Could you, either of you, talk about what seems to be a pretty light sentence for these particular transgressions?
Sure. The laws, the federal laws against steroid dealing are not harsh, certainly compared to crack cocaine or something. They're way light. So that's one reason for the light plea bargains in the case. The other is that the U.S. Attorney's Office over there allowed these guys to plead to these light sentences and no jail time and didn't want to take them to trial. That was a, you know, a prosecutorial choice. Sometimes it looks as though they have a little, I don't know, what do you call it, buyer's remorse or seller's remorse, that having done that, having, you know, dumped the case, basically, I mean, only two of the four defendants even went to jail, they seem to regret it. They were roundly criticized for it. And that may be, who knows, part of the energy behind this current attempt to get bonds for perjury, the jailing of Anderson and so forth. And certainly they're after Conti again. They want to get him as a leaker. Perhaps if these guys had been forced to plead to all 42 counts of the indictments, the judge would have sentenced them to longer than 4 months tops.
We've talked peripherally about Barry Bonds, but not necessarily directly. So I'd like to go to some sort of a multi-part question or topic of Barry Bonds. One questioner writes, as disagreeable and unlikable as Barry Bonds is portrayed, why haven't any baseball players or Giants employees come forward to support your findings? And so let's include that, but also have athletes criticized Bonds, top athletes criticized Bonds. To what degree do you think that race has played a part in the reporting about this? And finally, Bonds is on record as saying, when your closet is clean, come talk to me. How do you respond to that? Barry Bonds.
Okay.
To the issue of the Giants and their response to this and why they haven't come forward to support our work, I would point out that this is the franchise. This is the guy who's making this company millions of dollars. The Giants, unlike virtually every other Major League Baseball team, have an unusual situation. They have to pay off a $20 million debt every year at the start of the season for this privately funded ballpark. Bonds is the franchise. Bonds really runs this team, and the Giants have bent over backwards. There's two little anecdotes I'll try and tell quickly that are my favorite anecdotes that distinguish or that I think sort of underscore exactly the Giants' place in this or their feelings about it. One is that Greg Anderson gets indicted in February of 2004. This is at a time when he has spent, prior to that, many, many hours in the Giants clubhouse, developed relationships in which he has begun to distribute steroids to other ballplayers other than Bonds. And against, as it turns out, Major League Baseball rules, where there's a rule against having trainers in the clubhouse. But the Giants, like some other teams, to their credit, have circumvented the rule by just ignoring it, basically. After Anderson gets indicted in 2004, It's clear he's not going to be able to be around the ball club anymore, but Barry has a few other folks within his entourage who he'd like around him. Now, the Giants find themselves in a quandary. Major League Baseball is cracking down on having personal trainers in the clubhouse or anybody who's not authorized personnel. So the Giants' answer to this, because Barry has two folks he wants in the clubhouse, one is his personal stretching guru, and the other is a new weight trainer, is the Giants' answer to that is to hire them onto the payroll. And so these guys will now be officially Giants employees, even though they will work virtually exclusively with Bonds. So this is the Giants' response to that. The other is a quickie that relates to the book. When we went to see comment from the Giants on the book, and we talked to an official there and said, this is what we want to know. And they said, well, you know, we might talk to you. We might. Why don't you send us some written questions? So we did that. Lance and I put together about a dozen questions that we sent them. And a couple of months went past, and we were on the verge of the deadline of the book and sort of wondering what had happened to them and about to call them when we were in the office at 8:30 one night, fairly late at night, and my phone rang. And it was this Giants official who said, oh, Mark, I didn't expect to get you there. And I said, oh, hey, how's it going? And he said, you know, we've spent some time thinking about this, and we've just decided there's some questions we could answer, but for the most part, we just don't think it's good for us to answer any of these questions. And so they didn't. And I think those are the two things that sort of speak, and there's a volume of other stories that speak to why the Giants want no part of this story. As far as athletes speaking publicly about Bonds, more and more I think people, as Balco started to explode, more and more people became emboldened, though some of those players were somewhat fringe players. There's a pitcher named Turk Wendell from the Colorado Rockies who said, look, of course, this is ridiculous. This is around the time of the indictments. If my trainer got indicted for steroids, everybody would think, of course, I was getting steroids. And yet people are saying, well, maybe Barry wasn't getting steroids from this guy. So some athletes, Reggie Jackson even, felt emboldened to say a few things, and though he was quite quickly stifled by Major League Baseball. So some athletes have taken it on, but for the most part, there's a huge code of silence within sports and certainly in baseball more than anything else.
I guess there was a question, does race play a role in Balco or Bonds being prosecuted? I got to say, I suppose it does. It plays a role in everything else in this country, but I have trouble teasing it out in a coherent way as a motivator here. The Balco defendants are all honkies, if I could use that term. The Balco athletes are whites and Latinos and blacks, and what differentiates Bonds from the rest of them is he's so much better player. He's the only one who's broken the single-season home run record of the Balco athletes. He's the only one on a course to break the all-time home run record. He's the biggest star and the biggest paid, and I think that's why the scrutiny goes his way. He's also almost alone and absolutely denying doing anything wrong, and that provides additional scrutiny. Some people say, well, you know, why didn't anybody write stories like this about Mark McGwire, the great white hope for the Cardinals and that magic home run duel with Sammy Sosa back in 98. And Mark often points out the completely different dynamic that prevailed then as now. We, right or wrong, have been covering or trying to cover a federal investigation and following these feds around. They can compel people to talk to them, make people tell the truth. If you had been trying to cover McGwire's steroid use, because there's no question in my mind that he was using, just look at that congressional testimony of a year ago. But if you back in 98 had been trying to write that as a reporter, I don't think you could have gotten a satisfactory story. You could have gotten some unnamed sources that might have been saying some things, but it would not have been convincing evidence at all. It just wasn't there at the time. And that, rather than the race or how nice the guys are, I think really drives how the coverage went. Barry said to come back, said his closet's clean and I should come back when mine was, or all you lied or something. This was in a kind of temperamental press conference he gave at one point. I think he's just venting, and I understand the frustration of a wealthy athlete who's sort of had it his way his whole life, who's now being called into account for some of the things he's done that he's perhaps regrets doing. But shucks, I stand behind my stories, and I reckon my closet is clean. I certainly never took banned drugs to make $18 million a year. I haven't done that yet.
Given the taint on potential taint on Bond's record and others, what should be done about the statistics for this? And I'm going to direct that to Mark because you're the former sports writer.
Well, I always sort of dodge this by saying what I think will be done as opposed to what should be done. I mean, I think what will be done is nothing. I think that the commissioner's office has shown that they're not necessarily going to do anything about numbers. You know, you've rarely seen an asterisk in this sport. And when they did have one in Roger Maris's record for a while, that was removed. Shoeless Joe Jackson, the baseball player who was tied to the 1919 Black Sox scandal of gambling and throwing the World Series, his numbers remain on the books. I don't think baseball will do anything. I think the public will attach their own sort of personal asterisk to the numbers. I don't know how far that will carry 50 years from now, but I think for now people recognize the numbers for what they are, at least some people do. And I think the more telling thing will actually be the Hall of Fame. I think we're going to learn a lot, actually, this year when McGuire is up for the Hall of Fame, because that's going to be the first real ball player in the steroid era to come up with a vote. And, you know, I was at that congressional testimony in 2005, and for me, that was the moment that 98 was exposed for the fraud that it was, that McGuire was sort of evaporated for you know, McGuire's sort of star evaporated at that point. So I think it will be interesting to see how the baseball writers vote on this issue of McGuire, and that may tell you a little bit of something about what happens with Bonds when he comes up.
And yet McGuire was popular with most writers, and Bonds is anything but, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that, unfortunately, some voters base their vote perhaps on their interactions with the athlete, although I think for the most part, as much as that's an issue, the issue will be for these writers, many of whom I know, that I think they're just going to decide based on how they feel about the steroids issue. Some feel it's an acceptable form of what was happening in the game. They excuse it by saying baseball didn't you know, ban the drugs until 2003. And others will say, you know, this is not acceptable. Plus, I think it still remains to be seen what happens with Bonds because, you know, if he gets indicted, that changes the dynamic considerably.
Do you think he will be?
You want to? I mean,
you don't know for sure, but
I think they're close to making a decision on it, and it's really whether they have the will to do it. They've got evidence that they could put in front of a jury. Of course, they don't want to put evidence in front of a jury and come up short.
Back to organized baseball. Do you think Bud Selig should or will resign over this issue?
Oh, that's a good question. We've never been asked that. I'm confident that he will not resign. I think he reflects in his way the will of the sport. I think he's really in tune with what the people who own baseball want done here. They want to do as little as possible and somehow try to get past this darn thing by doing as little as is necessary. They'll do some things if forced. You know, the Mitchell investigation is a great example of that. I mean, I can't tell you how many times we broke stories at the Chronicle. We said, well, dang, we got them that time. I mean, there it is. They're going to have to do something. The first time we reported that federal investigators had been told Bonds and these other athletes, Giambi and Sheffield, were using steroids, we thought certainly baseball have to look at it. When we wrote about that recording I told you about, when we wrote the grand jury testimony, Giambi's admissions, it took the book and I suppose Sports Illustrated excerpting it for them finally to react to stuff that in some cases, if they'd been reading the paper like my mom and dad do, they would have known this years ago. They don't want to deal with it, but they will if absolutely forced either by public opinion or Congress. And I don't think that's just a decision Commissioner Selig is making.
I want to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Lance Williams and Mark Fainaruwada. Which is worse, a player using drugs or owners who manipulate, exploit, and blackmail the public to build stadiums at the taxpayer expense? And also, in their zeal, owners have inflated the player's salary where it's impossible for an average player just to afford to see a game. So talk about the economics of this.
Lance is chomping at
well,
the
no, I, I'm, I'm with you.
Oh, you wrote this question?
No, I actually asked my wife to submit that so I could say this. No, certainly the owners of the game share significant responsibility for what's going on. It's absolutely unfair to put it all on the players. We were just talking about this a second ago. You take a 24-year-old young athlete and put him in a situation where it's basically victory or death, and he's competing for a job against somebody else that put on 15 pounds of muscle in the off season, and you know how, what do you expect the guy to do? It's not fair to then come back and say, well, you're a moral reprobate, son, and we're going to punish you. The game has to be held responsible for this. And we both strongly believe that cleaning up baseball starts at the top. They've got to get serious about it. And it's not just pin the tail on the athlete.
I'm just going to, just because I have a personal, I can't agree more with it, that somebody introduced this notion of privately or publicly funded ballparks, and I have to jump on that because I wholeheartedly agree with the notion that it's a ridiculous thing. And you know, I'm a huge sports fan, but the notion that these multi-billion-dollar corporations basically should be funded by the public, I think, is a complete sham. And the way that it's being used by organizations now to basically hold up cities to keep teams from moving is a shame. And I, to me, my answer is always fine, move. I mean, as much as I would hate to see the Niners or the Raiders or the Giants or the A's or whomever move, go ahead. Because I think the notion that anybody should publicly fund these stadiums is ridiculous.
A couple of questioners raised the issue, the ongoing issue of the relationship between Barry Bonds and Greg Anderson. One said, what's your estimate on how much Bonds paid Anderson to keep quiet? And the other is not specifically about Bonds, but who's paying Greg Anderson's legal bills? I see he's being, you know, Mark Aregos is now being representing him. Is any insight on that?
We don't know the answers to those questions. They come to the minds of any thinking person. I think Gwen Knapp speculated on that stuff in her column today. Bonds would have to be careful about making any kind of payments while he's in the sights of a grand jury, because he'd have to worry about being accused of obstruction of justice. It's a complicated thing. Anderson is his employee.
Rumor has it that Victor Conti is your source. And if so, why protect the man at the center of the Balco scandal?
Well, you know, we're obviously a bit limited in what we can say on this topic. Plenty of rumors and plenty of speculation about who our sources are and have been. And I would just welcome everybody to follow the story. I don't think it's done. We will be filing a brief shortly. The government has filed briefs. We're in court on August the 4th. And it's an ongoing saga, and I guess that's about all I would say about it.
Have either of you read Canseco's book, Juiced, and how accurate do you think it is?
We both read Juiced carefully. I thought that when Canseco is writing about things he participated in or witnessed with his own eyes, he's been proven accurate time and again. When he's talking big picture stuff, conspiracy theories, speculation, he's not as reliable. But if you go back through the first 70 pages of that book and see what's unfolded since then, the outing of Rafael Palmeiro would be one thing I'd think of. McGuire's performance in Congress. I think Jose was present for those events and told the truth about them.
In your book, there was a small part about Bonds' family. He insisted on having his son in a photo at spring training, told reporters that he wanted them to see the effect on his family. What exactly was that effect?
I don't think we know the answer to that question either. I mean, one of the difficult things about the book I've always thought was that, you know, we're trying to basically write about these characters, you know, the newspaper is pretty straightforward. You're just sort of talking about what you've got, but in the book you can expand a little bit, try and get inside people's heads and try and get to motive. And that was a difficult aspect, I think, of the book while keeping on our sort of so-called journalistic hats and writing the book from that point of view. So I wouldn't speculate on what was inside Barry's head or what was inside his kids' heads or what their responses were. I think it was just, for our purposes, we noted it because we thought it was a revealing move by Bonds in the context of what was going on.
Simpler, what's your opinion of Juicing the Game by the Boston Globe writer? I'm trying to think of who.
Howard Bryan.
Howard Bryan.
We read Howard's book. We thought it was very thorough and very interesting. It's a big picture book about how the game changed in the 90s. He did not have evidence of steroid use by specific players. By and large, he's instead writing sort of baseball policy stuff. But he's a very well-informed guy.
I'm going to bring it back to journalism for a couple of last questions. One is the sort of investigative reporting that you do, is that strictly a newspaper thing, or can TV, radio, or online outlets do this sort of thing?
Lance has been an investigative reporter a lot longer than I have, as you can tell. But nobody got that. That you're older than I am. I think this material, you know, Lance was talking about this a couple of weeks ago at a conference of investigative reporters. The reporting we did was not anything more than sort of very nuts and bolts kind of reporting. I mean, it was a lot of phone calls to a lot of different people. It was being relentless in trying to find anybody and everybody who would talk to us. There was nothing, you know, remarkably innovative about it or different about it. It was just grinding away. It's hard slogging, as he likes to say. So I don't think that's reserved for newspaper reporters in any way.
You know, you have to give credit to the news organization. Any news organization can do investigative reporting if the boss wants it. And at the Chronicle, Phil Bronstein wants it, wants to do it, and pushes for it. And we couldn't have done any of this if the Chronicle didn't let us and encourage us and make it possible for us.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only time for one last question. And I'll ask each of you to respond to this, which is that when I finished your book, I felt disgusted in some sense. I mean, what is reported there is a very disgusting sequence of events, and I've been a sports fan for a long time. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but how would you recommend to people who want to be sport fans how they think about the games now? How should they approach this?
Well, I think that's a very difficult question. I mean, I think in San Francisco they clearly seem to be approaching it in a different way, or at least at the ballpark, than fans around the country are. I think that you can't help but watch the games, at least I can't, with a level of skepticism, and I think that's a part of it. I still find myself, in spite of that skepticism, able to enjoy watching whatever sports I'm watching. I mean, I think, you know, these athletes, whatever they're taking, are clearly some of them, you know, they're clearly the best athletes in the world, and they're doing things, you know, none of us could ever dream of doing. And I think that's the context in which you have to watch these games if you want to enjoy sport.
Demand a clean game. Demand it any way you want. If it's just booing the drug cheats at the ballpark, if the fans pressure the game, it'll respond. And if you get engaged in the issue and want to write a congressman, that's good too. But the game does respond to pressure. It has a bright future, baseball does, if it gets a handle on the steroid problem. If it doesn't, it's not a bright future at all. So if you care about the game, express yourself.
Our thanks tonight to Lance Williams and Mark Fanaru-Wada, San Francisco Chronicle reporters and authors of Game of Shadows, Barry Bonds, Balco, and a Steroid Scandal at Rock Professional Sports. We also thank our audience here and on radio. I'm Jim Bettinger, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.